Okay. Good morning, Professor Wolnitz. Thank you very much for joining us. It's a pleasure to be discussing. As we've mentioned ahead of this interview, the theme of this series is the history of Rubik's symmetry breaking in physics, which chronologically we bound roughly from 1975 to 1995. But obviously, we're going to be bleeding on both ends of this timeline in this particular interview. And to get us started, I have a couple of background questions I'd like to go through. With you. In particular, in your scientific memoir, which you published in 2013, you mentioned that reading extensively about physics and mathematics through your that you did do so throughout your adolescence. What drew you to chemistry after
Well,
that?
I think I started probably in chemistry because when I was a little boy, my father was a chemical engineer. So it was sort of natural to think about chemistry things. And in the in our library, sort of in our basement, we had lots of books that were the books my father had used in college in chemical engineering. And so that's probably where I'd read them. I mean, also there were other sort of popular science-ish things that say from Isaac Asimov, which were very sort of chemically oriented because he was a biochemist. And so I'm sure that's part of it. In fact, I do remember one weird thing, which was that my aunt, well, so very early on, I guess I thought I would be a chemist. And my aunt, one time when I was saying, oh, I was interested in other things, you're saying like, oh no, you've got to really concentrate and only go in that. And I didn't follow her advice that very well. But and obviously in school, in the lower grades and such, there's not that much opportunity to actually in the school itself do chemistry. So it was probably more that I was sort of recognized for doing mathematical things when I was a boy. And so in a way, when I went to college, for example, then the mathematicians were trying to get me to become a mathematician, not to be a chemist. But I sort of didn't quite go that way.
In that same memoir, you describe how in graduate school you initially wanted to work on critical phenomena, but felt that others that were already well underway with the topic. So instead, you looked into formalizing hydrodynamics through remote coupling theory
Right.
description. How did you get to that particular problem from your readings and
That's an interesting question. I'm not quite sure. In some ways, of course, the critical phenomena thing was in fact, I mean, I think if you really know the as you do, I'm sure the real history. Probably critical phenomena, the basic ideas had already really been done by the time I was there, but I wasn't really aware of that. There was still the sense of, well, it's not clear what's really going on. The Kadnoff Widom papers were considered very speculative. Wilson just became well known, I would say, my second year. And I remember going to Wilson's talks. Which he gave at Harvard. And it seemed to me the renormalization group was primarily a method of numerical integration, judging from how he presented it. I thought it was clever and interesting, but it didn't seem to be this powerful general way of looking at things. But it was clear that in some sense the static problem was solved. And I was always interested in dynamics. And I think at that time, because of course I was fascinated with that through chemistry, that I wanted to understand kinetics and things of that sort. And so I got interested in dynamic critical phenomena, which I think was still a little more on the edge of whether people would claim it was understood or not. And of course that also got connected up with the problem of long time tails in hydrodynamics. So that's how I got onto that problem originally. So my first paper is sort of the, like I said in the memoir, it's my only I would say almost rigorous paper in the sense that it proves some bounds within a certain model of mode coupling theory. But then I sort of looked at hydrodynamics, which was actually popularly being studied at at MIT, not at Harvard. And I said, well, the one thing that was missing, seemed to me, was the understanding of the boundary conditions. And so that's why I thought that was an interesting problem to turn to, whether boundary conditions were understood or not. Yeah.
So being in Cambridge at the time, were you at all in touch with people like Erwin Oppenheim, who also worked on recoupling ideas at
the time? Yeah. Well, not yes, yes, I was, although not in the sense of, working with him. I mean, I should say, I mean, at some point, although maybe this is a bad thing, but you know, as I also mentioned in the memoir, there was a sense that you really were supposed to find your own project and work on it. It wasn't the way I would say nowadays we do research in theoretical groups where, you know, you kind of expect the advisor to give you problems. I was never given any problems. I'd sort of come to these things. And there was a stage when I said I really needed to go talk to people other than my official advisor, which was Roy Gordon. And I'm sure I saw Oppenheim at that time, probably. A person I really did seriously talk to was John Ross, who was at MIT. And of course, also bit John Deutsch, who was also then going on sabbatical soon to Harvard. So those people I talked to a little bit. John Deutsch, much, much more so than to Oppenheim.
And what about Sidney Yip and Gene Mazenko, who were also...
I do remember meeting with Sidney Yip at some point in time. I'm not sure whether I did when I was a student. As you know, after I was a student at Harvard, I... postdoctored at MIT for about 6 months. And then I came back to Harvard as an assistant professor. And I think I met Yip sometime during that period when I was assistant professor. Mazenko, I never met. I don't know whether he was at MIT. I thought he was at Chicago or something around this time, but I don't know.
Not yet, but yes.
Yeah, okay.
So I mean, let me phrase maybe these questions differently. Can you describe the Cambridge community working on the statistical mechanics of liquids at that time? How was it structured? Were there...
Well, I think the statistical mechanics of liquids was being studied at MIT by Oppenheim and Deutsch. John Ross had done this sort of work at one time in the past. He was a postdoc of Kirkwood in the 50s. At Harvard, no one was interested in liquids in the chemistry department, and at that time, no one was interested in liquids in the physics department. I should be a little careful in the sense that I think David Nelson probably came when I was an assistant professor somewhere around that time. We certainly knew each other.
And Paul Martin had also been there.
And Paul Martin, I took classes from Paul Martin, but he actually did very little on what I would call liquids. I mean, he did write the Kaidenhoff-Martin paper on hydrodynamics, which was very important for me. But and he was on my PhD thesis defense. But I would say in general, ordinary liquids were not considered interesting. At that time.
So, I mean, were there sort of conferences or larger group meetings or seminar series that were bringing people, or this was really just individual people working on
the topic? Just individual people. The only thing that was probably quite relevant, and even relevant for this story about the glasses, was actually Ben Whittam did come and give a class, probably in my last year or maybe the year before, I can't quite remember, which was on critical phenomena, which I attended and listened to. Edouard Brazin gave a class on calculating huge numbers of diagrams in the renormalization group, which I went to. But liquids per se were not really considered interesting. Even Harvard, I would say, had a somewhat negative view on statistical mechanics. One of the very most, I mean, one of the nicer, nicest people, I would even say, but in the physical chemistry group was a guy named Bill Klemperer, who was actually a very, very nice person, but I remember him once, it was famous. He was famous for saying that if you were doing an experiment that required statistical mechanics to interpret it, you were doing the wrong experiment. So that was sort of the attitude.
So as you mentioned earlier, after your PhD and a quick postdoc at MIT, you came back to Harvard as a junior faculty. Right. And during that time, you worked on at least what looks from the outside more classical physical chemistry problems, such as solvation, electron hopping, and biopolymer dynamics. In general, what drew your choice of research problems at that point?
Well, I sort of defined, and you can even still see this when I, you know, when I do these one word, one line things of what do I do. I really was interested in what I called many body chemistry, that especially at Harvard, the attitude was that, and it's still true through most of chemistry, the attitude was the molecule was the thing. And your goal was to get down to studying an individual molecule and what molecules do. And there was no sense that, and so that's in the way that statistical mechanics in a way was always a failure if you were doing statistical mechanics. But then that seemed to me that it left out these phenomena like that would have sort of many body aspects, which I'd been interested in from being an undergrad. So I sort of looked around and I was always interested in chemical rate phenomena. And actually, again, that was more or less ignored in the liquid phase. So I said, oh, that's an opportunity to say something interesting anew. So, for example, now, of course, everyone knows the Cramer's theory, but actually the Cramer's theory was basically completely unknown in the chemical community at that time. And so just the general ideas of what goes on in reactions in liquids was very unclear. So in fact, actually the glass problem, I mean, which I guess is where we come to with the RSB, I started to, even though I didn't publish on it, apparently, at Harvard, when I was assistant professor, that's when I became interested in it. It seemed to me that it was going to be a very easy problem, that the main thing that was not understood was how you could get a barrier that it seemed to me, first of all, it was obvious that it had involved something that had activated dynamics. And in that sense, it had to be the same as the reactions that I was studying. And that the only issue was that it was somehow some kind of collective activation barrier that involved a barrier being created by coupling to other things that have barriers. So I was pretty sure that we could do that problem. And it was sort of an envoi problem I gave to Jim Skinner, who was my first research student. And that was with the goal of looking at glasses. But what we did find was that there, and I had this sort of idea that maybe a similar thing would be going on in simple polymers or something. And we came up with this way of describing the dynamics of polymers using solitons, which led to two papers. And then also Jim went off and did sort of kinetic Ising model, one-dimensional kinetic Ising models, which had sort of the same idea of something was overcoming a barrier that's coupled to something next to it. And so on. I mean, I guess we would now actually call it a facilitation style of model or something. So that was you know, the only, you know, published work that came out of that. I remember two things about glasses, though. I was deeply involved in it. And one was, I remember Turnbull gave a seminar, which I went to. And that was one thing that impressed me, that there was really an interesting general phenomenon here. And I got interested enough that I invited Austin Angel to give a Harvard MIT physical chemistry colloquium. And he came and he actually had a demo of making a glass that was very good. It was a really excellent seminar. It went over like an absolute lead balloon. Nobody else thought it was interesting at all. He felt that. He wanted to not accept his honorarium or travel expenses because he felt his talk was so poorly received. But I think I somehow got him to accept the money And it was just kind of silly, but that was, anyway, kind of played a role in my own thinking.
So it's through Turnbull's expose that really you became.
I would probably say that's what made me realize there was something there. Yeah, that there was something, you know, that was sort of a hard to understand problem. And of course, Turnbull, you know, had done practical things with this, you know, and even I would say, you know, made, you know, key contributions to even the understanding of the phenomenon, right? And very early on. But at this point, he was more interested in, I would say, practical things with making metallic glasses and stuff like that.
So you then moved to Illinois, where you pursued, I mean, different yet similar problems, I would say, on solvation and quantum mechanics effects and chemistry. Can you describe the chemical physics community and ambience at Illinois? Was it in any way different from what you?
Well, I would say, you know, obviously one difference was now I was one of the, you know, senior people. You know, when I first came, obviously David Chandler was the person who invited me to come, and I interacted with him. He was there were interests, and we collaborated on some quantum things. I'd been interested in quantum things for rates, and those turned out to be quite well known. The theory group in physics, just went over and interacted, you know, through seminars and things of that sort primarily, although I interacted sort of very deeply with Hans Fraunfelder, who was an experimentalist, and he was interested in dynamics in biological molecules and also in glasses. So he sort of was one of the people that sort of allowed me to interact, you know, I mean, or encouraged other people to interact with me at Illinois. So over the years, my interaction with the physics theorists grew, although I would say, I don't think actually I have any collaborative papers with a theorist in the physics department, but I would, you know, be part of their, you know, team of, you know, people. So I felt pretty much, you know, a good part of that community.
So your first Illinois PhD student, James Peters Tressel, you came back, you know, with him, you came back to more liquid state interests or more clearly.
Right.
Looking specifically at glasses, what made you think that this was now the right time to tackle this?
Well, it never stopped. Okay. I mean, you know, I thought about glasses all of this time. I had this idea that and sort of one of the other things I'd been interested in, of course, was the problems of chaos and basically the origins of chaos, and it seemed to me that the problem of glass was the question of why do you have something that's a crystal but it's not a periodic crystal. So it struck me that it was exactly a sort of some sort of origin of chaos thing. And I started with the picture that you could do this by a sort of transfer matrix method, that the transfer matrix, you would sort of study hard spheres in a tube. And the idea is you would march along the tube. And basically, if you were to write down a density functional for minimization equations would be they would be a sort of time development as you moved along the tube. And so it seemed like there would be a transition to having periodic tube states to at some point having period doubling and then chaos and blah, blah, blah. So that's where I really wanted to go. That idea never really fully blossomed, but I said, well, but look, we already know there are aperiodic minima because of this work of Bernal. So I said, why don't we start with those and try to do the theory of aperiodic structures, whether they're stable or not. And that's what came on with Jimmy.
I mean, that was a pretty unique approach at the time, as far as I can tell. No one had really started from the stability of the solid. But where did you get exposed to these ideas of Bernal and Finney about disordered solids?
Probably very early when you read about metallic glasses, I would guess. I must have read about Bernal. It seemed like I always knew about Bernal then. Yeah.
Okay, so you didn't meet Finney at any point of that.
No, never. But not I, you know, it's conceivable I might have met Finney at some point. I remember he worked on water, and it was possible I saw him at a Water Gordon conference or something, but I never interact with him on glasses or anything. Yeah.
Had you paid any attention to the work of Goetze and co-workers like Lightheiser,
Yes,
Sjögren?
because of mode coupling theory, I did. Yes.
Yeah, but at that, when did you become acquainted or aware of this in your?
Probably knew about it, probably when the works came out, I would guess.
Okay.
At this point, I'd never met Goetze. Some years later, after I'd done the work on the sort of mapping the mode coupling theory, the density functional, and so on, I was at a conference in Copenhagen where I met Goetze, and Goetze and was a kind of an odd interaction because Goetze, I was basically on Goetze's side. He gave a talk on the mode coupling theory of glass transition. I thought he was basically right, but he was incredibly obnoxious. And all the people who came from the sort of glassy community, spin glass community, they just attacked him viciously. And he gave back as much as he got. And I was kind of on his side, but he wasn't somebody who wanted any allies, I thought. So that's the only time I ran into him.
So getting back to the 1985 or your work with your first student at Illinois, you as you said, there's two approaches. You looked at a sort of linear stability and then a DFT approach. Where did you become acquainted with DFT or
I
with these
think
approaches?
whenever you look at the theory of liquids around this time, DFT was sort of a natural thing to do. Most of the and so I knew this because of all the sort of diagrammatic theory of liquids that was around. Probably the papers of Oxtoby and Rice on periodic crystal formation were on my mind, and that's a little bit what was clearly going into this idea that there was some sort of transition from periodicity to chaos or something like that. But it was very awkward to try to build things out of density waves. And at some point, I think I said, oh, but we know their structures, let's use Gaussians. So we had originally thought of the Gaussians, and actually about the same time, a little bit afterwards, a guy named Terrazona did Gaussians for the ordinary periodic crystal, sort of scooped us in a way. But also I didn't even think to do that. I thought it was clear it would work for the periodic crystal, so why bother? But but we did that sort of independently.
But all of this mostly through papers, or were you in touch?
Just papers.
Okay, so there's no gatherings or conferences that you attended where
No, I'm sure I
ideas.
went to the Liquids Gordon conferences in those times, and it's possible there are people that I'm sure I talked about the density functional theory of the aperiodic crystals I think I did at a Liquids Gordon conference. I'm not 100% sure at that time. Yeah, that's probably right.
In that 1985 PRL, you cited Mézard and co-workers' work on spin glasses. So how familiar with you with spin glasses and ideas of replica symmetry breaking
Well,
at
I
that
didn't
point?
know about I hardly knew anything really. I knew the Edwards and Anderson papers because the which I think I think don't get appreciated as much as they really ought to be. Still, I really am fans of those papers because I think they really did sort of identify that there was a kind of mean fieldish approach. But they actually had two really different mean field approaches, one of which was the one that sort of took off in the big way, which was the, you know, we're just averaging over the JIJs. But then they also had something where they said, well, we could look at this in a dynamical way. We could take a spin and it would be moving and it has a random force put on it by the other spins through the JIJ, which gives some kind of additional damping to their motion. And I realized that was the same as the theory of the, more or less the same theory as dielectric friction, which I'd already worked on. So I said, oh, that's really a good way to think about this problem, that it's a crisis of friction in the spin glass. Mm. Those things I knew quite well. I knew, therefore, the replica general technique from those early papers, but then the elaborated technologies of showing that there were multiple stages of replica symmetry breaking and so on. I knew they existed. I looked at those papers, and I'm sure I cited them, but I would say they were pretty obscure to me as to what was going on.
What was the immediate response to these first couple of papers on glasses? Any recollection?
I don't remember any particular response from people. Maybe they were of interest. I mean, it, certainly in a broad way. I think I probably talked about these with, I remember I may have met Ted Kirkpatrick earlier because of his connection with the University of Maryland, and he was a student of Dorfman, and Dorfman knew me from my thesis, actually, on mode coupling. So I might have met him earlier, but I definitely talked to him at a Aspen meeting, where at the Aspen meeting, which was probably in 85, so it must have been soon on this, and I said it seemed to me that the mode coupling theory and the density functional theory must be related because they have the same mathematical objects in them, you know, direct correlation functions and blah blah blah, and that's where I sort of took over, sort of realized you could do mode coupling theory of the glass transition more or less along the lines of the Edwards Anderson argument, right? The Edwards Anderson argument was this friction crisis, and that's how I sort of derived this so-called naive mode coupling theory. He and I think we more or less worked out everything of that paper at this meeting in Aspen, except perhaps the closed form results for some things that we sort of knew that I'd had this idea from Frisch that stuff should be simple in high dimensions because the virial expansion truncates, and then we just got these weird closed form solutions that I remember, sorry, weird formulas that I remember getting to the stage of having a whole bunch of Bessel functions in them. And Ted figured out their asymptotics so that we got this, I would say, still extremely elegant result that, you know, the density was something like square root 2 pi e, some powers of d. And all the powers are right, and the square root of 2 pi e differs from Francesco's calculation by about 10%, which is still puzzled to me. Because, square root 2 pi e is a really nice answer. 4.71653, well, it's a numerical result. It always bothered me, but anyway.
So I think you presented that series of work also at the International Conference on the Theory of Structures of Non-Crystalline Solids at the Institute of Amorphous Solids at the University of Michigan in June of 85.
Yes, there was a meeting there. It was mostly by this guy. There was a guy there named Stan Ovshinsky, who mm-hmm. was who used amorphous semiconductors for things. It was very controversial, but that's where I talked about it. Again, I would say there wasn't very much interest in that there. The Kirkpatrick work, that first Kirkpatrick work, happened just before, I guess it would have been 87, although I really should have to check exactly the dates. I know our daughter was just 6 months old, so I have to check exactly when she's born. But I organized with Dan Stein a workshop at the ITP on relaxation and complex systems. And we had lots of people that were on site there for the whole time, lots of people that were there for short periods of time. I think Ted came out for maybe 2 or 3 weeks, and we worked out some more stuff there. I do remember a result, you know, you say in terms of how people respond, there was a conference at the end. And the conference at the end, I know I talked about the sort of density functional and the mode coupling density functional thing, probably started to say something about the activated events, although I don't know for sure. We were certainly thinking about it. And somehow at the end, someone proposed that we should have a vote of the people attending the meeting, which there were about 100 people, I guess. Maybe it was less, maybe it was 50, but a large group of people. The vote was, is there a large length scale involved in the glass transition? Okay, or a large meaning a growing one. And the vote was essentially unanimous that there was not, except for two people. That was me and Dan Stein. And Dan told me he really didn't believe there was a large length scale involved, but he thought I would feel upset if I was the only person who thought it. So he was being nice to me as a friend. So so I would say that the idea that there was something critical, something phase transitiony going on was definitely not popular, even though this was presented. And probably there were other talks on, I'm sure, spin glasses and maybe even random magnets. I think Jim Cessna spent time there. But usually I would say that there was kind of this like desire to believe there was that there wasn't really a problem here.
In your first paper with Professor Kirkpatrick, you thanked or acknowledged conversations with your PhD student at the time, Joseph Brynjolfsson, and with Dave Termoli. Had you met Dave Termoli at that point, or was this?
I very likely had met him. I know that I talked about these things with Joe. Joe was at the workshop, and Joe worked on glassy things connected with protein folding with me. I probably tried to get him to do some calculations on regular glasses, but he didn't do anything on that, to my knowledge. I knew Thirumalai because he had applied to postdoc with me years before, and I didn't have any money, so he worked with Bruce Byrne, but I didn't talk with him. I don't recall talking with him at all about glasses in this time period. He might have come to the meeting in Santa Barbara. I don't remember that really, but I didn't directly. So that acknowledgement is Ted talking to Thirumalai, I believe. Yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, Professor Kirkpatrick was writing papers with Dave Thirumalai also at about the same time as you were. How was the overall? It's not a collaboration, but how was this dynamics playing?
Well, it was a little bit, I would say and actually I sent you, for example, some letters that I wrote with Kirkpatrick. One of the letters from Ted actually describes the sequence of collaborative events, right? There's a paper where he, so I would say that the original, the first paper with Ted, which talks about the the high dimensional glass, I never had the impression Ted was involved in any real way. And of course, that paper also is what mentions the connection to the Potts glass as sort of an aside at the end, but it is where it's mentioned. And then the other two papers, the next paper is a paper by Ted and Dave where they analyze the P spin model by mode coupling theory. And again, that paper says that it's following the suggestion of the KW paper, which is reference one, that there's a connection of the things spin glasses. And it's a kind of, it's a very technical paper, I would say, and it had sort of some puzzling aspects, like there was a dynamic transition and there was a separate thermodynamic transition, but it's written in a way that it's a little bit hard to say what's going on, I would say, for me. And so that's what led to the second Kirkpatrick-Wallenis paper, which is this paper where we used, where we basically understood the dynamical transition to be a spinodal. That makes you say it's a brand, and again, it was being called a first order like transition or a discontinuous transition. But now we would say the TA was the spinodal for the transition and the TK is the ultimate transition. And I was convinced that that had to be connected to the entropy problem because that's what we knew from experiment. And so that's why we did this analysis of counting the states using this method of Thouless, Anderson, and Palmer. You can see I was really not very comfortable with replicas. So it was all done by this Thouless, Anderson, Palmer method. And we got then that the entropy vanishes at the equilibrium transition. And then that paper also does some discussion of what the correlation lengths are, that one correlation length grows at TA, another one grows at TK, which is caused by a kind of instanton mechanism, which is discussed in there.
So, but from a practical standpoint, I guess most of the ideas flew or pivoted through Professor Kirkpatrick. So you would hear from their work and then they would,
probably,
I would hear from your work.
Yeah. Okay. And I'm sure vice versa. Yeah.
So in that first paper, again, you mentioned that, you understood that the description, the mean field theory, would become exact in the limit of high dimensionality. Given that you had some experience doing molecular simulations, or at least Monte Carlo, did the idea of doing simulations in higher dimensions cross your mind at that point?
I would say no, because I used to have a theorem that used to be true. It's still almost true, which was a theorem that you can never learn anything about a glass transition by simulation. Because the timescale problems were so severe that if you're trying to explain this, orders and orders of magnitude growth of timescale, that means the naive way to do that would require orders and orders of magnitude more time than computer time, and we didn't have that much even with the supercomputers of the day. So, like I say, that was a theorem. And in fact, it was interesting, I would say, tracing back to the sort of prehistory of this. Most of the people who did simulations never believed in any of this phase transitionist stuff. So, for example, Stillinger, I'm not sure even to this day he has any belief in the entropy crisis, for example. He did lots of simulations. I once mentioned to him in the early 90s, about the Parisi style work, and he said, "Oh, that ridiculous work of the foreigners." He didn't believe anything that came out of that thing. But also like Hans Andersen. So Hans Andersen, his first simulations, which he published, led to his not really seeing something like a mode coupling transition. Then he sort of invented these facilitated models where he showed that they didn't have a transition, which was motivated by his simulations. And then he slowly got to, as his computer got better and better, he got to a time where he now said, oh, yes, there is a mode coupling transition, but there's no other one. So I would say generally as computers got better, simulators got more and more, interested. So that, say, finally, by the time of my Festschrift, which is like when I was 60, there's an article in the Festschrift by D.E. Shaw, where he does O-terphenyl, and he simulates it now for a few microseconds. And he says, it looks like we're starting to see a transition. So I think there was a sense that you're not going to get a transition in three dimensions. I don't know. It's possible if one had thought about higher dimensions that would have made sense. But as as someone who's done the simulations in higher dimensions, the 3 to the d power doesn't give you a lot of room if d is a very big number, right? So,
So as you mentioned, you were doing tap type calculations, and then there were some replica ideas in your papers. How was your work received, these early couple of papers with Professor Kirkpatrick, by the spin glass communities and the structural in Europe in particular? Were they aware of these advances?
It'd be hard for me to say when, certainly not immediately. I wasn't in general contact with them. I must have been, in fact, I'm not sure exactly when. Obviously, by the year 2000, yes, a little bit, but somewhere in the 90s, I don't remember anyone from that. I mean, it's interesting. I knew Parisi a little bit. I didn't really know him, but I knew of him because he did these quantum Monte Carlo calculations on QCD. And so I was doing quantum Monte Carlo in the early 80s, and he visited Urbana. And I remember everyone saying, oh, he's the new Fermi. I always kid him about that. I said, you have a lot to live up to because, you're the new Fermi. But again, I don't think there was any back and forth with that community. But somewhere or other in that time, there's some sense that there's a connection made. I don't remember exactly when. Yeah.
Okay. So you don't remember going to Paris or to Rome to give seminars or to talk about?
I definitely went to Paris. Okay. Yes, I did. I spent the summer of probably 93 or 94 at the École Normale. I mostly talked about protein folding, but I did talk about, it's hard for me to believe I didn't talk about the theory of glasses in one seminar. I met Derrida, I met Mazart, I met Toulouse. I'm trying to think who else. There was a fellow who invited me, was Vanimenus, I guess is how you say his name. They were very nice to me and everything, but I would say there was no collaboration. Didn't seem like it was going to happen or anything. Yeah.
Okay, I see.
I was already feeling like I was moving on to the protein stuff at this time, and kind of felt like, well, the glass problem is solved. Now I need to do other things.
So just stepping back a bit, in 1988, you worked together on the actual joint paper between you and Dave Thermolay and Ted Kirkpatrick on scaling concepts for the dynamics of viscous liquids near an ideal glassy state. What led you to join forces at that stage?
Well, the interaction with Ted just continued. If you look at the notes which I sent you, they I was in Japan, so I had to write. Everything was being done by writing. I guess there was email, but we called it BitNet. and I don't know anything about, there's very little. I don't think Ted used BitNet. I hardly used BitNet. more or less, I would say, directly in those notes, we went back and forth on different scaling ideas, basically on how you could get this, that we wanted to have something that was instanton-like from our previous paper. And then there, the question was, what's the exponent for the mismatch, what we now would call the mismatch energy? Ted thought it had to be less than d minus 1 over 2 because of an argument of Danny Fisher. I said I'm agnostic about it at first, so I'll let it be a coefficient y. But then I said, if you insist that there's only one length, which is what you need for a scaling theory, then you end up with fixing the value of y so that the length exponent turns out to be 2 over d. And then the Fogel-Fulcher law follows. And so I remember the moment, literally, where I found that, which was in Japan. So in Japan, I remember, you know, playing around with the numbers, like the little bits of algebra, and I saw that you came with the exact Fogel-Fulcher law. And then I said, that's it. So then the rest of the emails, not emails, regular mails go back and forth arguing about this. Ted finally, I would say he kind of, you know, oscillates back and forth over the next year, like, because d over 2 is bigger than d minus 1 over 2. Although, you know, not, I don't think you can completely rule it out just on experiment. D minus 1 over 2 would kind of be okay, I think. And then I don't know about the conversations he was having with Dave. I do know that at some point after we got back and we were writing the paper up, we debated whether Dave should be part of the paper. And Ted argued, see, I had no knowledge of Dave being involved, really, other than sort of someone to talk to. And then he sort of argued that his interaction with Dave was critical and that he should be a co-author of the paper.
Okay, so you never went to Maryland. You actually never worked with Dave or exchanged with Dave there.
Right. Yeah, we never shared any. It's possible that I know there was an email or something in there, and it's possible that I might have talked to him on the phone or something. But in general, my conversations were with Ted.
I see. What was the reaction to that work? I mean, did you present this at a Gordon conference on liquids? Did you go around and give many seminars?
I don't know. I mean, I did talk about it at this, but that's, of course, a completely weird place. I talked about it in, it would have had to be 87, or probably 87, but with the wrong value of the exponent, at the Hans Frauenfelder Festschrift in Urbana, because just before I went to Japan, I talked about it there. And so I wrote the article in Japan with the new scaling argument as in the speculation part of the paper. I gave a talk about it when I got back from Japan. I gave one of the first seminars that I had gave back, I gave it at UT Austin. And I do remember one part of thing that was interesting about that is there's a fellow you may know from another part of your life, a guy named Rich Friesner. Rich Friesner, I met with him after my seminar, which is unusual. And then he said, oh, that was really a nice seminar. It's probably the last interesting seminar with analytical results I'll ever see. I do remember that. So he liked it. But overall, I would say I didn't hear too much about that then. We used things from this in other papers in proteins. And I would say the protein work is what I mostly would talk about. And more or less in the middle of the 90s, there was something that caused me to really go back to this a little bit, which was Phil Anderson, who I greatly respect, I still greatly respect. I think he's a real hero of 20th century physics. They ask him, what is the most important unsolved problem? And this is quoted a lot. He said this thing in Science where he said, the most important unsolved problem is the problem of the glass transition. And I remember reading that and going like, well, that pisses me off. I remember, I obviously haven't impressed Anderson. And because the problem is solved. There's a paper. So I kind of re-enter the field around the year 1999 with this paper with Shaoyu Sha in PNAS. And I'd always held that the problem with this scaling argument is things never get very, very big in terms of the distance that you go. So the only way to test a theory like this, to my mind, is to be to calculate things microscopically. In my opinion, this is not held by anyone else these days, but I believe that a theory, the only way to test a theory like this would be to be able to calculate some experimental number for a real thing, not that actually exists in the laboratory in three dimensions. I thought that what we now, I guess, call RFOT theory, I said, when I compared that to everything else that was going on, I said, but it's the only theory that even lets you start to do a microscopic calculation. No other theory says how to start and carry out a calculation. The student Shaoyu didn't want to work on proteins. So I said, well, why don't we look at this problem? And I thought he was going to have to do a very elaborated calculation. He was a little bit, he's a really brilliant guy, actually a big hedge fund guy now, but made a lot of money. He only wanted to write three papers. He was doing a finance degree at the same time. And I tried to persuade him the calculation would be easier than it seemed. And then one of the weird ideas was this idea that if the interface were sharp, that you could calculate the surface tension by this kind of argument that's more or less the analog of how we calculate the surface tension of a liquid by saying you lose half the bonds. And so we did that calculation. And then when I did it, I said, oh my God, if this is true, the coefficient is purely entropic and you can calculate it for any substance. So that paper allowed us to sort of say, even though it's a microscopic calculation, there's a general way to map it onto other materials. And that's what we did in that paper a little bit. And then later the paper in the PRL for calculating beta and for other things. So it's kind of it was one of those like moments of revelation that, there was no reason why the calculation should turn out nice. But it turned out that when you did the calculation, it looks like you have to have a very, very, within that sharp interface approximation, you'd have to have a very universal result. Not universal like critical phenomenology, but universal like the way the van der Waals equation works for, rare gases pretty well.
I'd like to go back a bit to the protein work, actually, before we move to that second period. And tie in some of the loose ends we left. I mean, you mentioned Dan Stein, who, as a friend, you organized the ITP workshop. When you first started working on protein foldings and the relationship with glasses with Joe Brigginson, you worked on, you sort of built on the work of Dan Stein. So how did you get interested in this idea? Was this through your interaction with Fraunfelder or with Dan Stein?
It was mostly through Fraunfelder. I would say that I wouldn't have said, actually, I built on the work of Stein at all, actually. I knew about it, but I didn't, because he made a very, very, and although I think Dan got his motivations from interacting with Hans indirectly as well, which was to try to explain the glassy dynamics of the already folded protein, which was sort of what was showing up in Hans's kinetic experiments. And I think in discussions with Hans, we started to really talk about the that there must be some relationship to whatever is going on in spin glasses with this hierarchical energy landscape. You know, Hans always liked the hierarchical nature of the landscape a great deal. So that was one thing. And then, but I also sort of felt like the folding problem was different. So the folding problem, the problem isn't just where do you put the side chains, it's how do you even organize the polymer in the first place. So it really has to do with bringing things in contact that are, you know, not even on a lattice or anything like that. So, and then as I, Joe and I tried about 7 or 8 different kinds of approximations that would be like, you know, some sort of replica type thing for a polymer with interactions. And then we said, well, everything seems like it's just coming out like a random energy model. So we said, why don't we just assume it's a random energy model? And then when you calculate that, then you see that the random energy model transition isn't like folding at all. That it doesn't have a significant latent heat. And so that's why we postulated that it's really the competition of the glass transition of a random heteropolymer with the, you might call it the crystallization transition of the evolved sequences. So it's kind of the Turnbull story. Turnbull was trying to find materials that have a hard time crystallizing. Evolution was trying to find things that have an easy time crystallizing. And so that sort of analogy between the, you know, what makes something crystallizable or freezable as opposed to glassy, that was what was on our mind in that paper.
I see. Yeah. At about the same time, people like Thomas Garel and Henri Orland were also working on similar approaches, I mean, broadly speaking. Were you at all in touch with these groups?
I didn't know of their work. I mean, another person who was doing things at a similar time was Eugene Shoknovich, you know, who also was doing things with, and he was doing, I think both Orlan and Gael did things with sort of the full replica technologies. And like I say, at first, I guess I was still always somewhat skeptical of those as a technology in my hands. Anyway, I mean, later we have done things with replicas, but we tried to do things with lesser means.
So I mean, brings a question a bit. How did you become acquainted with replicas, or how were you teaching yourself?
Probably read the literature. I mean, you know, as I knew about replicas from the Edwards Anderson papers, and I also remember at some point coming across the lectures of Anderson in, and this might be where I started to hear about it. I'm not sure. An article that made a big impact on me anyway was this article by Anderson in Les Zouches on the matière mal condensée. He has a lot of side issues in there where he actually does deal a little bit with glasses and probably even mentions the entropy problem. He certainly mentions something which I think has been ignored by most people, but was a keystone for me, is, you know, that if you, he said, actually, it was one of the things I've only met Anderson a couple of times, and I was always, I was very impressed with him, partly because of his style, which I kind of really like. He actually knows things, and he's not just a technique guy. And so one of the things that he points out is if you take the entropy, if you take the two-level systems that you have in glasses and you integrate up their heat capacity up to the glass transition, they give you only about 1/100th of the residual entropy. So a lot of people who are trying, I would say even today, who try to make the theory of glasses be exactly the same as the theory of some two-level system entities that then interact, let's say. People will remain nameless here. I would say that that struck me as very interesting, that the things that you see in the two-level systems are maybe related to the glass transition, but they're not the objects which are finally loosened up, whatever, at TG, at least in a simple way.
So getting back to heteropolymers, I mean, as you said, there's many groups who were coming to these ideas at roughly the same time. How was the community structured? Were there conferences where you all met, or no?
Not for me. I mean, I don't mean there were no conferences. I mean, I mentioned this conference in Copenhagen. There was the workshop we had in Santa Barbara, and at least some of these people were there, like Danny Fisher, I think, came to our meeting in Santa Barbara, and Sefna was there. Generally, I would guess they were, again, well, there was this kind of, I would call it, I used to say that I was a mid-Atlantic theorist in this, that more or less the people in Europe believed in replicas, and more or less people in the United States didn't believe anything that came from replicas. And I was sort of in between. Like I felt like there were some things you could use from replicas, but that it wasn't the full answer. But usually it was formulated by the Americans as what's really wrong with this replica method, and how it misses everything. That was sort of how it was presented in most conferences that I went to that involved people on disordered systems. And I'm not sure, I mean, even by people like Danny was very, very much against them. He knew them techniques very, very well. But, you know, he has a few papers where he does replica calculations for, I think, like the interface problem or something like that. So he's definitely, it's not that he doesn't know them, but he just doesn't like them, or didn't like them at that time anyway.
As part of that series of papers and that effort, you eventually collaborated with Dave Thermalay on in that field as well. You had a paper together. Had you kept in touch throughout since the glass work, or was this just a...
That paper is a strange paper. The paper you're thinking about is a short paper in... it's a one-page paper in Science, I believe, because that's the only other paper I've written with Dave Thermalay. So the origin of this was, I would say, Dave appreciated what Joe and I said fairly early, and he wrote a couple of simulational papers on, they may or may not have been lattice models, but they're highly simplified models, where he mentions those ideas and sort of mentions something about the gap in the energy spectrum, which is of course the same idea as there being a high FTF to TG, what we would call the minimal frustration principle. So he definitely mentioned that, and he was aware of that. Around this time, these ideas started to become more interesting to people. I would say the experts really knew about the stuff quite well, but I would say they didn't necessarily, talk about it in that way. And we wrote a paper. I was very much, again, kind of annoyed with some of these papers, because there was a study of these lattice models, and they would use them as a way of sort of talking about real things, but they never tried to map things onto real systems. So already in 1989, I was already writing simulation papers with, using machine learning to get potentials to fold real proteins that have, you know, names and pictures and stuff, not on the lattice. So we worked off lattice. But then this lattice stuff kind of got in, and I thought that one of the ways to bring these things together was to try to see how you could map the lattice problem onto a real protein. And part of the key idea was that there was some structure formation to start with that was very local in sequence, the formation of secondary structure. And so we had a theory of how much entropy that removes. And so again, since entropy is the main story of all of this, we were able to sort of make a mapping of the lattice model onto a real protein through calculation of the amount of entropy that was lost. And so we kind of came to this idea that the lattice model that everyone was studying, the so-called 27 cube, really was not bad as a model of maybe a 16-mer or something like that. The nice thing about the 27 cube was all of its compact states could be enumerated. Mm-hmm. So you didn't have to simulate things. So the Wallenius theorem that you can't learn anything by simulation is still true, but you don't have to simulate it. You just know what the energy spectrum is. So José Onuchek had sort of taken up some of this stuff and had written some lattice simulations. And so we started an interaction again, José and me. José had worked with me actually at Santa Barbara when he was a student still at Caltech. Then we said, oh, we'll write a paper that maps the lattice problem onto the real problem. And that's what led to this picture of the funnel. And so what happened was that how Thirumalai was involved was Thirumalai somehow contacted someone at Science, or was contacted by people at Science. And they said, well, shouldn't you write some paper on all these lattice things or some short news brief thing on that? He contacted us and we basically wrote that one page paper, which was kind of a summary really of the previous paper with José, as well as a simulation that Dave had done separately with his simplified model. So there's a picture in there of his simplified model protein. So those were the ingredients of that paper. And then we sent it. And I would say it was a very key paper because first of all, it was short, people could read it. The figure is more or less the same figure as in the Owls paper, as we call it. I mean, I chose that title because it was supposed to be clever, with the order of authors is so that it spells Onuchek, Wallenius, Luthi, Schulten, Sochi. So it's Owls, the wise guys. I didn't know I was going to move to Rice, where the signal of our school is Owls. But so that's the Owls paper. But the Science drawing staff redrew it. And they just did such a brilliant job with all the colors. I mean, I'm actually very proud of the first figure because, you know, most people draw these funnel pictures and they just draw something that looks like a funnel. But I had just read this book by Tufte on the visual presentation of quantitative data. And he said, well, you know, you should really try to put as much information in a figure that's quantitative as you can. So it turns out that that figure has many things shown on it, like this is how big the entropy is, this is how much the energy loss, this is how big the barriers are. All those are the results of theories. They're real numbers. They may not be exact numbers. They're far from exact, in fact, but they're numbers that are meant to be taken seriously on the figure. So it's not just a hand-drawn figure. So that's why I was very proud of that being real science and not just a drawing. But the Science guys did a better job drawing it than the first one, but still preserved most of the numbers, right? So it came out very nicely, I think. So that's why the paper is so well cited, I think.
A couple of years later, you wrote a review for the annual reviews of physical chemistry with José Onuchek and Zan Schulten again. Right. And you have a statement in there that an extremely important statistical mechanical tool for investigating the connection between the microscopic forces and the energy landscape of proteins and heteropolymers has been the replica methods for spin glass theory.
Yeah.
So you mentioned earlier how there's, you know, definitely in the spin glass world and maybe in the structural glass world, there was different views across the Atlantic. Was somehow ideas of replica better accepted in the heteropolymer world? Or was this just
I don't
your
think
own?
so. I don't think so. I mean, I wrote. Well, first of all, I mean, as I said, Eugene Shostakovich wrote some things with replicas. Although I think one of the issues with his way of doing it was he made some really not necessary additional approximations that made it very hard to compare it to anything kind of real. I mean, but the ideas are there for sure. But I would say that takes away from their applicability to real systems. On the other hand, then we with Masaki Sasai, we started to do replicas and try to do a little bit better approximation on the polymer physics, and also apply it to this associative memory Hamiltonian that we'd started to use as a practical tool to predict structure. And actually, the paper we write this paper with replicas, where we use a variational approximation for the assumed ansatz of the replica symmetry breaking, and it's basically almost the exact same thing that Mazard and Parisi did at essentially the same time for the random interface problem. So that's a place where we used it. I think that just made us feel confident of the random energy model style results. With Shoji Takada, we also looked at instantons in the replica method first before we had ever applied it to structural glasses. There had been the tap equation use of the instantons in the 1987 paper, but this was the first one where we used sort of replica instantons. And so, a key problem there was that basically the although you can make an argument that the fully connected model is a good thing for think about proteins because proteins aren't all that big, it also turns out to be true that proteins are not all that big, but they're not all that little either. So in fact, the mechanism of folding involves a finite part of even a 60-mer, and a 60-mer, an 80-mer, maybe a third of it really is involved in the transition state for folding. And so that's why we needed to have a sort of nucleation-like picture to understand things. But I would say the real folding, all those papers had very little impact on the experimentalists in protein folding or other theorists who worked on folding at the time. I mean, even most of the community was a simulation-based community. Yeah, and so that those sort of questions didn't seem to excite them very much.
I see. So that brings us back to where we were a little before, about in the late 90s, so 1999, early 2000s, where you go back to issues of or problems of structural glasses. You actually had two PhD students, Vasily Lubchenko and Zhaoyue Xia, working on the topic, I think in parallel. But mostly, what drew you back to the problem at that point?
Well, like I said, I think they're not quite in parallel. I think Shaoyu is a little bit earlier, although I'd have to be a little bit careful about exactly whether I think they overlapped. And actually, what Voss was supposed to work on originally was a completely different thing, okay, related to the two-level systems. Okay, so let's come back. So Shaoyu, it was because he didn't want to do anything on biological stuff, and I said, "Well, I still would like to just show people that you can do this microscopic calculation." And so he was very, very good with that, and he did the calculation, and then he did the calculation with the where we added in, I would say, for the first time, worried about the fluctuations, so that one could explain the stretch exponential. The stretch exponentials were, of course, a big deal in all of the glassy physics. It was the kind of thing that attracted Hans to, saying there was a landscape. And I would say the stretch exponential is the clearest proof there's a landscape, that there's something that's heterogeneous. But none of the previous work paid any attention to that, as far as I could tell, or certainly didn't do a theory. So it turned out to be a very nice theory that you could get telling about how the stretching exponent was somewhat related to the heat capacity and that works reasonably well. So Shaoyu, I wanted to have come to San Diego, but he said, oh, you know, I've been taking these classes in finance. I have a job arranged at McKinsey. I want to just get out of here. And I said, well, okay. You know, he had three papers, and it was a sort of, they're good papers, very good papers. So he passed my minimal standards. And he's, you know, he worked, turned out to be a very rich guy on the basis of this. He has his own hedge fund and so on. Mm-hmm. I often joke, I guess it's a bad one, as my group once brought to me this information. They said, oh, we just saw Shaoyu Shaw in the news. He just paid a $3 million fine to the Securities and Exchange Commission. And I said, oh, that shows he's very successful because he's able to pay the $3 million fine. but anyway, he's actually a very nice guy. So what we were doing with Voss was a kind of an interesting story, and was not really related to, it was connected with glasses, but not related to the glass transition originally. What had happened was I'd heard from Tony Leggett. He had talked about people had studied the two-level systems in glasses. One of the major experimental groups was a guy named Andy Anderson, who was the head of the physics department. So a lot of experiments had been done on this. And Tony, first of all, says, and I'm not says, he's correct. Tony independently proposed the two-level system idea for the low-temperature prevalence glasses. He proposed it independently, maybe slightly earlier than Anderson, Halperin, and Varma. So he was very interested in this. And he noticed that there was this weird universality of the properties. But if you sort of say, I sprinkle in some two-level systems, they should, why should they have any universal properties at all? And so he pointed this out. And then he tried to say, well, this must be because it's really that the two-level systems interact with each other, and they've got to be renormalized in some way that you end up with a universal result. So he did a calculation with Claire Yu of this, and it's a very kind of interesting calculation, obscure calculation. It ends up suggesting there's universality, but it's off by a factor of at least 100. Okay. So I said, well, in talking to Voss, he had worked on some tunneling and bath problems when he was a master's student. And I said, well, look, I know how to do tunneling in a bath much better than Tony, actually, because we wrote more papers with Monte Carlo. I'm sure he just made some mistakes, and we should just do the calculation right. So I had Voss start on various better approximations for two-level systems in baths, made up of two-level systems. And he would get sort of the same answer as Claire and Tony. Then I'd say, well, why don't you try this approximation? And he tried another approximation, and he also got more or less their answer again. And he kept doing this about five or six times, and he got very discouraged. And so he just wasn't getting anywhere. And I said, well, you know, you've just got to write up your calculation. We know it gives the wrong answer, but if it gives the wrong answer, and you've done this calculus so many times, it still will get you a thesis. So just finish the goddamn thing. And so I said, why don't you come out with me to San Diego? I was moving to San Diego, and I'm going to sit on you till you finish this. So he still kept doing more approximations, always getting the same answer that Tony did. But he still wouldn't write anything up. And I said, oh, he's just getting bored. I've got to make this problem more interesting. So I said, what if the two-level systems lived on the boundaries of the mosaic? That would give him some spatial order in there, and then now the problem would be more fun. So I calculated how many borders there would be, what fraction of them would have a low enough energy to tunnel, and the answer came out to be the experimental number. So that's how the paper then we changed completely to just say that those are the two level systems. It's not every, it's only the quantum active ones are only a fraction of the guys which are at the borders of the mosaic. And so that's how he did this. So originally it was not supposed to be connected to the glass transition problem at all. It was supposed to be a tunneling in the bath problem, but it didn't turn out to be that way. Anyway.
So the way you frame it, it sounds like this revival of interest had nothing to do with the advances made in the meantime by Jean-Philippe Bouchot, Marc Mézard, and Parisi, who had started looking at replicated liquids. And I mean, did you follow at all the work that had happened in the replica world?
I probably knew the replicated liquid. No, I definitely know it now. I probably knew it probably by the year 2000 or so. I think that paper is like, I'm thinking it's like 1998 or something like that is the first paper.
96, I think, but yes.
Yeah, so. Okay. And I remember that the problem with the paper was that it used the hypernetted chain equation, which I had a very bad reputation in liquid state theory for things that had hard spheres. So and also it didn't really try to get, the original papers didn't really try to get exactly transition densities or anything. So I kind of didn't pay a lot of attention to it. The first first calculation we did with a non-random system with replicas was with Jörg Schmalian. So Jörg Schmalian, I'd met at some probably either Aspen or ICAM. And Jörg had been a postdoc of David Pine's, but I'd never met him at Illinois. But he came from a polymer background. But
didn't you co-author a paper together with David Pine? I thought you
later in a paper with David Pine's, but it's a, which I can tell you a story about, but it's a think piece paper. It's not I've never wrote a real research paper with David.
Okay, but you did not interact with Jörg Schmalian at that point.
No, but then he, at Aspen, or probably Aspen, or maybe another ICAM meeting or something, a meeting probably organized by David Pines, he said, well, I think this glass stuff might be really relevant for the high-temperature superconductors. There's all these stripes. There's also this other stuff that goes on. Do you think that could be playing a role? And I said, oh, yeah, maybe so. And he I would say he took the lead really, and sort of with my just holding his hand, saying, well, you know, maybe we could try using these replica techniques for the stripe Hamiltonian, and he came up with using the Monisson style analysis for that system. So that's how we got into the. That's probably the only one where we officially used replicas for a non-random system. So the papers titled something like self-generated randomness in striped glasses or something like that. Yeah. But technically it's almost the same as the HNC paper, I guess, but the Hamiltonian is a Landau style field theoretic Hamiltonian. And then sort of with Jörg, then also later there were several other glass things that came from talking more with Jörg.
Yeah, I mean, one in particular where you actually computed instantons in the field
theory of RFOT. Right.
See, what was the driving force? Was this really, again, his ideas and you helped him along, or did you have a particular interest in this topic?
Well, I always, you know, I've always liked the instantons. I don't remember exactly, you know, who said we should do some instantons there. I think we knew, of course, probably the first paper on the striped glass certainly is aware that there, that what you needed to see in the experiment was something having to do with time scales. But I would say we never really, all of that stuff, well, when we put in the numbers with the Landau sort of starting Hamiltonian, like trying to do it for a real glass, I would say they don't work really as smoothly or as nicely as when you say, matter is made up of atoms, which can only vibrate about 1/10 of a particle spacing before they find a new kind of minimum. That the sort of Landau Hamiltonian for crystallization is really not very good. And so that's why I would say quantitatively, we don't use that for too much. Well, I think the other thing I did with Jörg and Jörg was very, I think we're all very fascinated with this question of the spinodal behavior, the TA. And, you know, there's all kinds of arguments about that. And of course, really solving mode coupling equations, as you know, you have to sort of know lots of liquid state values. And then you still end up with questions of, you know, should I really take a factor of two difference of temperatures as being meaningful or not, for example. So we were interested in that. We had some discussions, and I think he may have been the one who brought to mind, although I knew the work, this work of Klein on the metastability of an ordinary first order transition. And sort of I translated that into an argument for the barriers. It's kind of there in his in the Klein thing. And then that turned out to work very, very well for understanding what the crossover phenomena were, where they would occur, again, in terms of the numbers. So that led to a whole series of papers on that, starting with Jörg, Jake Stevenson,
But so by the early 2000, I think you were much more in regular contact with the European community working on the systems. Can you, what sort of meetings would you?
First, I would say meaningful contact I would have. Well, first of all, I mean, you know, I don't know. There may have been other interactions, but I wouldn't say it was in 2000, but, you know, the XW calculations, you know, started to take numbers very seriously. And I gave a talk about, you talk about where you give talks. I gave a talk about the XW, theory, at Berkeley, at David Chandler, who I had bad interactions with for about 20 years. He invited me to give a talk at the Berkeley Statistical Mechanics meeting. And I gave a talk on the XW things there, and everything was all fine, I would say. About 5 months later, I get this email from David Chandler saying, oh, here's what I think you meant to say in your talk. And it was a description of this kinetically facilitated model that he had a preprint on. And I wrote back to him, I said, no, that isn't what I wanted to say at all. But anyway, there were a lot of emails from him with lots of capital letters. I've got to say, I'm very proud of myself. I don't use capital letters too much in emails. So he had this story. Now, this is where we get into the interaction with Europe. Somehow, Bouchot and Baroli were aware, maybe you should ask them directly, but they certainly were aware of Chandler's work. And they wrote a paper that pointed out that, Chandler's main story was that these are kinetic effects. They have nothing to do with thermodynamics. Therefore, any correlation with the heat capacity is just silly, okay? Like, which is a key result of RFOT to my way of thinking, certainly to the entropy crisis, but also to even the heat capacity. So he turned his models around. He turned his models around and he calculated. He sort of said, well, look, depending on how fragile things are in his model, he would also find that the heat capacity would go in more or less the same way as an experiment, that the more fragile it was, the more the heat capacity was. And he wrote down a formula for that, which was a formula, I think, with lots of proportionality signs in it. Okay. So what Bouchot and Baroli did was they calculated the actual result of Chandler and showed that it was possibly true for his model, but that the heat capacity was 100 times larger than what it is in real life. Okay, it's hard to make a mistake in heat capacity by that much, in that direction for sure. And they sent in a paper to JCP, and I was a referee of the paper, and I said, it's a great paper. Then I waited, and some months later, maybe 9 months later, I said, well, you know, whatever happened to that paper of Bouchot and Baroli? And I wrote to them, I said, you know, you realize I was the referee of your paper. Could you tell me where it appeared? I'd like to cite it. And they said, oh, it's never appeared. Then they showed me the correspondence they'd had with the author, with the editors of JCP, who was actually a great guy. Marshall Frixman passed away, but he's a good person. For some reason, he had decided that even though the paper was a paper, that he viewed it as a comment on Chandler's paper and had sent it to him to referee also. And then he wrote incredibly scathing reviews saying it should not be published, blah, 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 blah. And so they compromised on having back-to-back papers where Chandler sort of says, I never meant equals, I just mean there's a proportionality. But of course, so that's how I ended up having interactions with Baroli and Bouchot, because I commiserated with them about how that happened. And, you know, I'm sorry American journals treat you this way, but what can I do? So then they, I think that's around the time they came up with this point-to-set correlation paper, which was very, very, has a lot of parallels with the paper I just written with Voss on aging, Voss Lubchenco on aging. And because we use this idea that you think about ever larger regions and what are the states in those regions and stuff. So they published that paper. And I think that paper had a very big influence on people, you know. Well, first of all, it kind of made clearer that about the length scale question being a key question. There's also an experimental paper by Baroli, Bouchot, and several other people, the experimentalists, I've forgotten who was the first author, but where they sort of get these inequalities, whatever, on length scale. And, that I think brought out the length scale question was under some degree of control, let's say.
In an interview published in 2010, you're cited as saying that results from the prior 20 years or so should already be part of the curriculum.
Yeah.
What have you done to include this material in the curriculum? In particular, did you ever teach about spin and ore structure of glasses and replica symmetry breaking at Illinois?
Well, sort of. I mean, I've taught since about 2010. I haven't taught an ordinary. I've taught typically been taking courses that were sort of on biomolecules. I did a course that's on it's called Biomolecular Concepts. And in Biomolecular Concepts, about a third of the way through, we start to talk about folding, and therefore we introduce the random energy model and how that interplays with the ordinary folding transition, and then use those ideas quite a lot. I've in the last few years, I've been teaching a course which is supposed to be, again, a mixed, that was a sort of mixed undergrad-grad course. And last 3 years, I've been teaching a new class for me, which was called Chemical Kinetics, which is a mixed undergrad-grad course that used to be sort of gas phase, chemical reaction dynamics. And as I say, we start with the Greeks and end with my papers. I mean, so that, I mean, literally, actually, the first of the course is a it turns out one of the nice things about Rice is when you enter the campus, there's a small inscription that most of the students have never read, but because it's in Greek. But I came across this, and the inscription says, Democritus, it is said, would rather discover a single law of physics than become the emperor of Persia, which I think is a great place to start. And of course, the students don't read that anymore, I guess. But then we end with nucleation and glasses and protein folding are the last few lectures of that course. And again, basically through more or less the random energy model for the protein folding and something like the simple parts of nucleation and the RFOT argument, but not really the full-blown replica technology. Yeah.
So just to make sure I understood, when did you start teaching about the REM? Was this around 2010 or this was before?
Oh, I'm sure I've taught about that. I did that in San Diego.
Okay.
So that would be 2005, something like that. Yeah. I mean, the REM is so easy, right? I mean, you know, it's actually, I would say, easier than almost any, most things that we teach in statistical mechanics class. I mean, you know, I mean, I think the problem with the REM is it looks so incredibly easy. You go like, I've been swindled. You feel it must have been swindled. I'm sure that's what Derrida thought. I mean, if you read the Derrida paper is quite complicated, but I think it's because he's trying to convince himself the simple answer was right. And of course, to some extent, that's maybe where other people see the value of his paper. But my viewpoint was, well, that's more or less fine and simple. And then the connection between the REM and the POTS system is basically just that you first have to establish that you have minima. And then once you have minima that are unrelated to each other, then it's the REM all over again. So that's why I think those are, at that level, that's easy enough to teach to people.
So in that same interview, you expressed some exasperation at the fact that in the 90s, people told you, and I quote, they would be happy if there was a theory of structural glasses that would reproduce the macroscopic experimental trends, the more remarkable strange behaviors, and be exact in some limit. Those desires have since been satisfied. Yet it seems that the ideas remain challenging for some. What do you think underlies such refraction?
Well, I think, first of all, I would still say, unfortunately, that statement remains true, which is a little exasperating to me. I would say there's been a slight change that since that was written in 2010, you more often now people say something with RFOT, they'll say something like it's the leading theory of glasses or something like that, but we need to do something more. I don't mean that there's nothing more to do, but I just mean that I think that way of viewing things, I think, is a little strange. I mean, it's certainly true for, the same is true of BCS theory, for example. There still were things to do in BCS theory long after it was being used to calculate lots of stuff. I think that the main, I mean, some of it may be just some kind of social inertia. I think one of the other really fundamental problems is, well, there's two fundamental problems that couple. I would say that barrier crossing seems to be just apparently considered a mystery to most people who come from a condensed matter physics background. I can even trace this back to Feynman. Feynman, in his lectures on volume one, he talks about chemical reaction rates. And he has actually a pretty good description of chemical reaction rates. But he says, you know, the problem with chemical reaction rates is they depend exponentially on these energies. And because of that, it's probably not even worth thinking about anything more than figuring out what the activation barrier is. And even that, you're not likely to be able to get very good experimental results because it's so sensitive. So you could argue Feynman already tells you you should avoid this problem. But I would say in general, you know, even Cramer's, you know, I think is well known to now chemical physicists, but very, very only lightly known in the rest of the physics community. And so I think the fact that there's an activated event going on here, there's this sense of that must be a mystery. I think that's at least one of the reasons. The other reason is, of course, there's this intense fascination with universality, and the only type of universality that is completely kosher is the universality of large length scales that comes from the renormalization group. And the real problem so first of all, that problem I think is quite interesting, but resolving it is, to my mind, not important for understanding any experiment today because the length scales never get that big. Maybe there's some regime, some other kind of one-step replica symmetry breaking system where you will be able to access huge length scales. So I think it's not a wrong thing to think about, but I think that's one of the problems. Many of the objections to the renormalization group treatments of the dynamics of random first order transitions are equally valid for nucleation theory of liquids out of gases or crystals out of liquids. If you really want to be a purist, you can say we don't understand nucleation at all, despite the fact that we calculate things and use ideas from it all the time to make actual materials. So I think that some of it is that kind of pure, because there's no infinite length scale involved in nucleation. And once you come to the critical point, it's not really, it's spinodal again. So I think that that's one of the reasons why these aspects there. First of all, I mean, I agree. I don't know whether there will be a system that you can actually take down to TK and see that there's a finite or a sub-extensive number of aperiodic structures that have essentially the same energy per particle. I don't know if that will be, if that such a system actually exists. For real materials made of single substances, I tend to agree with Anderson. They will crystallize. The unit cell might have 300 particles in it, but they'll probably crystallize. So I think that may be an issue there. So I think those are the reasons why it still stays active. These sort of, in a way, like I say, this sense that the actual physical system just isn't something that is that we can't say anything about it because it has too many details, I think.
So we're nearing the end of this interview. So yeah. Is there anything else you would like to share with us about this era that we may have missed that would be germane to our conversation?
Well, no, I mean, it sounds to me like these are the things that I think are most relevant there. Like I say, I think, I mean, the only thing that's, there are many things that haven't come up in this 2-hour presentation or whatever, that I think it's, again, show why I think the problem is actually still quite rich, despite this sense that I have that the basic ideas are probably sound. There have been a lot of new phenomena found in the last 20 years, like the ultra-stable glasses that Mark Ettinger found. They've led to the ability to see if there's actual front propagation in such things. There's a huge amount of engineering, other ways to transform one glass into another glass. there's been interest. I've spent a lot of time on the connection of glasses with soft matter and the cytoskeleton and biology and stuff like that. That's still an area that's kind of got a lot of activity in it, but I would say nobody's reaching a full consensus on active matter there. So I think that there's, I guess one of the things that, like I say, frustrates me is it's not so much to sort of go like, yes, we just celebrate the great thing of the past. It's that understanding that some stuff is understood gives you tools to do new problems. And I think it's a little bit frustrating to see that there's all sorts of frontiers for us to explore, but we spend a lot of our time worrying about the past rather than about the future. Now, that's a bad thing to say to somebody who's doing a historical study of this. I love the past. My middle daughter is a professor of medieval history, so we like the past in our family. But I would just say that in the thing that's a little bit, you know, like I would say, exasperating in this thing is that there's a lot of new things to do, and new things that had been done that aren't explored enough because of this sort of fixation on asymptopia that we have.
So finally, I mean, I know you have notes that you've kept from that epoch. Do you have a plan to deposit them in an academic archive at some point?
I hadn't. I certainly don't have a plan. I mean, I guess I assumed when I died, somebody might go through these things. But, that especially from this era before email, we have lots of, notes and so on. I don't keep lab notebooks.
But you do have correspondence
in the correspondence. And so there's a lot of correspondence on various problems in these periods. Unfortunately, I mean, a lot of science, especially in proteins, we did it with people who are actually around. And so we didn't, the stuff is found in the papers and such. I think this was sort of a weird case where a lot of it was done where, two of us were in really different places. And so we did have letters going back and forth for part of it. So that, I don't know, but we'll see whether people, I'm not sure quite I'm up to the level where people want to keep all my correspondence, but I'm keeping it in case that sometimes, is seen for someone. Anyway.
Professor Rollness, thank you very much for this conversation.
Thank you. Okay. Bye-bye.